The U.S. imposes sanctions for a variety of reasons. The most egregious examples are cases in which another country violates the sovereignty of a third party. So the example here would be Russia's annexation of the Crimea in 2014. Generally speaking, the United States very much frowns upon the idea of using force to change borders, and therefore sanctions are almost always a automatic imposition when that happens.
Welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, the entirely student-run podcast at Johns Hopkins University. I'm your host, Julia Ahn. You are listening to another installment of our Foreign Policy Toolbox series, where we unravel the mysteries of the most important institutions, concepts, and policies that decision-makers actually use to implement foreign policy. In the last decade, economic sanctions have increasingly become a foreign policy tool of choice in the United States, with the U.S. designating over 1,000 entities per year during Trump's presidency. So how does the U.S. decide which individuals are sanctioned and how sanctions are enforced? In this episode, we will discuss these questions as well as delve into the controversy behind the current U.S. sanctions policy. Joining us today is Professor Daniel Dresner. Daniel Dresner is Professor of International Politics at Tufts University, a non-resident senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs, and a contributing editor at the Washington Post. Previously holding positions with the RAND Corporation and the U.S. Department of Treasury. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Professor Dresner, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
So to begin, could you please just start and describe what sanctions are exactly, or what economic sanctions are, and briefly, what is the process of sanctioning a country in the U.S.?
Okay, so the conceptual definition is easier. Economic sanctions are generally efforts to disrupt, block, or otherwise hamper economic exchange across countries. And the usual presumption is that if economic sanctions are imposed, the idea is that they will be lifted provided the targeted actor changes their behavior or reverses course on a particular policy or what have you. With respect to how economic sanctions are imposed by the United States, that is a much more complicated question. The United States has a tremendous number of laws on the books that enable the federal government to impose economic sanctions, but they vary in terms of their scope and domain and which agency is responsible for them. So sometimes the United States will pass laws that simply imply that they will comply with United Nations Security Council sanctions. In other instances, laws are passed by Congress enabling the Commerce Department to disrupt trade. However, the bulk of U.S. sanctions at this point are financial in nature and therefore are run from the Treasury Department, specifically the U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control. Also, Congress passes a series of law, or Congress has passed a series of laws imposing sanctions, but sometimes those laws are extremely specific. Sanctions, you know, against Iran or Russia or the Global Magnitsky Act, for that matter, which authorizes the punishment of individuals. And then there's more generic legislation that is out there, the most prominent of which is IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, that authorizes the president to disrupt economic exchange if they feel there is some sort of national emergency. This really has been used by presidents, by and large, to impose sanctions on who they want in terms of furthering the national interest. But it occasionally leads to some absurd declarations, like the U.S. imposing sanctions on Venezuela back in 2015, for example, declaring that it was a national emergency when you could argue there were issues with Venezuela, but it certainly wasn't a national emergency. And in fact, I had one senior Obama administration official tell me that they were sort of embarrassed that they even had to go through that rigmarole.
I see. So you said that that Congress can, for example, pass laws that include sanctioning a country. But I also know, and as you referred to, other groups like OFAC under the Treasury Department can also do, like they also have a blacklist, for example, of 6,000 specially designated nationals, and they routinely add and remove to that. So I guess my question is, are these different sanctions passed or imposed by different groups differentially regulated? Is there different oversight between, say, a sanction that was passed in a law by Congress versus OFAC's blacklist, which seems like it's just added to and removed by OFAC specifically?
The answer is largely yes, in that, you know, the designated actors list that OFAC runs is almost entirely regulated by OFAC. And there's now, I believe, a pretty routinized process by which people can petition to be removed from that list, because one of the complicating factors is that sometimes OFAC imposes sanctions on someone that they think is the target, but it just turns out they share the same name or something along those lines. Or in some instances, it's based on bad intel, and so as a result, that has to be reversed. When the sanctions are mandated by Congress, that's a slightly more complicated issue, in that most sanctions legislation that is passed by Congress also contains a national interest waiver. This isn't a general rule, but it's pretty common. And the national interest waiver allows the president to waive the sanctions if they believe that to be in the national interest of the United States. So, for example, again, when the Obama administration lifted sanctions on Cuba, they by and large did that by using the national interest waiver. The problem is that that only lasts as long as the president deems it to be in the national interest. And in the case of the Cuba sanctions, when President Trump was elected, he basically reversed course. So if sanctions are mandated by Congress, the only way to guarantee their removal is for Congress in turn to pass legislation revoking.
And just a quick question. So that waiver where the president is able to remove sanctions, does that just apply to sanctions passed by Congress, or does that apply to also, say, OFAC's blacklist?
I mean, it almost de facto applies to OFAC's blacklist, because if the president deems something in the national interest in terms of lifting sanctions against a targeted entity, that's the president commanding the executive branch to change something, and the president has the full authority to do so.
And so then what are some reasons for which sanctions are commonly enacted by the U.S.? And could you kind of take us through the process of what happens after the U.S. sanctions a country?
Oh, Julia, what aren't sanctions imposed on by the United States for the purposes of other for advancing the U.S. national interest? The U.S. imposes sanctions for a variety of reasons. The most egregious examples are cases in which another country violates the sovereignty of a third party. So the example here would be Russia's annexation of the Crimea in 2014. Generally speaking, the United States very much frowns upon the idea of using force to change borders, and therefore sanctions are almost always a automatic imposition when that happens. Sanctions are also imposed for a variety of other reasons. The three, I think, largest categories, I would wager to say, are first, counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. So sanctions are often imposed against entities and countries if they are seen as aiders and abettors of terrorism. And we've seen this basically since the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. The second category is nonproliferation. The United States has a dedicated interest in preventing the spread of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. Unsurprisingly, the United States therefore imposes sanctions against countries that are suspected of running afoul of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as well as the Chemical and Biological Weapons Convention, and therefore will impose sanctions for that purpose. The third reason is human rights, which is a sort of broadly defined category. Which is, if a government is perceived as repressing its own population's human rights, whether we're talking about the Uyghurs in China or ethnic minorities in other populations, or LGBTQIA populations in other countries that aren't necessarily terribly tolerant, sanctions will be imposed. A related reason for that, I mean, it's not so much human rights, it's democracy, but very often if someone is trying to stay in power and they lose a democratic election, but argue that the election was rigged or what have you, and try to stay in power, very often the United States will impose sanctions on that leader until they exit office. We see this, for example, in the case of Zimbabwe, you know, going back years, as well as to some extent Venezuela.
And so what happens after the U.S. imposes a sanction, say, for its various departments or also third-party countries? What do they do?
Well, it depends on the nature of the sanction. Mm-hmm. If the sanction is trade-related, meaning we have decided we are going to raise tariffs or revoke most favored nation trading status or revoke the generalized system of preferences, then essentially, you know, that law is the relevant parties are notified of this. And firms that want to then trade with that country or with entities within that country will have to pay in order to be able to do so. In terms of how that affects third parties, the answer is that it provides an opportunity for sanction busting. The United States has the power in terms of trade to affect its own producers. It doesn't necessarily have the capacity to produce or to restrict third-party trade. And indeed, this is why trade sanctions are often viewed as not terrifically effective, because not only do they offer basically an incentive to engage in black market activity for what was previously heretofore entirely legal transactions. Most U.S. firms that would engage in international trade are multinational corporations, and therefore, while the U.S. affiliate might abstain from trading, it might be that you could have a foreign affiliate of that same corporation try to circumvent the sanctions. But those are trade sanctions, which, as I said, are not terrifically popular anymore, although there are still a few of them on the books. If it's a financial sanction involving OFAC, that's a separate conversation, because essentially what happens then is that OFAC notifies financial institutions that it would view exchange with whatever the targeted entities are, whether it's a private bank or a country central bank, depending upon what the nature of the sanction, as being illegal. And therefore, there are entities, most prominently SWIFT, which is a nonprofit entity set up in Belgium that essentially enables banks to exchange information and therefore money across borders. If SWIFT essentially delists a sanctioned bank, that bank can't do business with anyone, at least through conventional financial means. And therefore, they will be cut off from the international financial system.
I see. So then, to kind of change course a little bit, it seems like based on what we talked about, sanctions on entire countries could economically cripple that country, especially if they depended on trade with the U.S. So how does the U.S. evaluate risks before sanctioning a country, including whether or not it would create political or economic instability that may lead to power vacuums or extremism? And does the U.S. have a process to review or have oversight over sanctions regimes after they've been imposed?
Well, let me answer the second question first, which is to say, by and large, no. In fact, the GAO did a study, I believe in 2019, the Government Accountability Office, of the extent to which federal agencies, particularly state and treasury, actually did try to monitor the effect of sanctions. And the answers they got was that by and large, they didn't. They relied on intelligence agencies, namely the CIA, NSA, and the rest of the intelligence community, to sort of assess what is going on in the country that is being sanctioned. So there is little sort of year-to-year or day-to-day monitoring of the effects of sanctions on targeted countries, because again, the notion is that if that country acquiesces, then the sanctions will be lifted and the problem will be solved. As to your first question about whether or not the United States weighs the costs and benefits of imposing sanctions in the first place in terms of causing instability or what have you, I would preface that by pointing out that very often the target of economic sanctions is already unstable and potentially acting out in such a way that that's why you're talking about sanctions in the first place. So it's not like you know, the United States is looking at France and thinking, how can we sanction them for something that they have done? Usually it is a country that or a government that is already behaving badly, at least from the perspective of the United States. As to whether or not they think that or whether or not they assess whether the sanctions will have more deleterious effects, to be honest, I think this ranges from administration to administration. There is no routinized process. One would assume that this would be something under discussion at the National Security Council staff level. But to be fair, it should also be noted that U.S. policymakers' understanding of sanctions as a effective tool has varied widely over the years. We were having this conversation 20 years ago. People would be talking about how sanctions, by and large, are a symbolic, largely empty tool of political symbolism. That is not what policymakers think now. They think that sanctions have the potential to seriously punish countries. And they're not necessarily wrong with that. These sanctions are incredibly potent. There is a third element that is worth bringing up at this point, which is sometimes sanctions are imposed on a country, and it's not necessarily expected that that country is going to acquiesce. But the reason you're imposing the sanctions isn't just to punish or compel that country, it's to send a signal to other countries that are considering similar forms of behavior. So in this way, for example, the U.S. sanctions on Russia in the wake of the annexation of Crimea and interference in eastern Ukraine, it wasn't like U.S. policymakers thought that Russian troops were going to leave Crimea or exit the Donbas. However, there are other governments out there that have maybe considered the possibility of expanding their borders. And in some ways, you could argue this was an effective way of sending a signal. These will be the repercussions. And there is some evidence, although this is very hard to prove, that with respect to human rights or nonproliferation, sanctions, tough sanctions that have been imposed on some states have had a chilling effect on other potential targets from either pursuing nuclear weapons or engaging in additional human rights repression.
I noticed that you touched a little bit about the conversation about sanctions, say, 20 years ago, and I wanted to get into a little more of the history of sanctions and ask you, when and why did sanctions become a major foreign policy tool in the U.S.? Has it always been one, or was there another tool of economic statecraft that the U.S. employed before, say, before its dominance on the global scale?
So in one sense, sanctions are as old as the Republic itself. The United States began imposing economic sanctions, most famously, I believe, in the 1808 or 1809 Embargo Act, when Thomas Jefferson, who was annoyed that U.S. sailors were being imprisoned by both Napoleonic France and Great Britain during the Napoleonic Wars, decided that the United States would refrain from trading with both the United Kingdom and France. That was a catastrophically poor policy decision on Jefferson's part, since the British and French economies were much larger than the U.S. economy at the time, and therefore that was a minor inconvenience for the European powers and a tremendous inconvenience to the United States. Now, the good news is that sanctions as a general tool of U.S. foreign policy really doesn't do that much until the end of World War I, when Woodrow Wilson proposes sanctions as a sort of principal means through which the League of Nations would presumably police its own members. But to answer your other question, primarily, the way in terms of economic statecraft, particularly since about 1933, the chief way that the United States has tried to influence other actors is not so much through sanctions, but rather through trade concessions, through signing trade agreements, through additional economic concessions like the Generalized System of Preferences for developing countries, or the African Growth and Opportunity Act, things like, or the USMCA, and so forth. So, generally speaking, the United States, since the end of World War II, has been an advocate of trade liberalization, and it is viewed, offering trade agreements to other countries, both through the multilateral process of the GATT and WTO, but also through regional and minilateral trade agreements, as a means of cementing closer ties. So it's not that the United States didn't sanction. Sanctions were still a part of post-war foreign policy, but they were more of a minor key than a major key. What has happened over the last 20 years, though, is two things. First, as I said before, the United States has gotten better at sanctioning. Essentially, what has happened is that beginning around the late 90s, and particularly following 9/11, the federal government began to appreciate the power of financial sanctions, of actually hurting targeted elites rather than necessarily the mass public, which, let's say, the post-1991 UN sanctions on Iraq did, and soured just about everyone on the idea of comprehensive trade embargoes. So financial sanctions, and the United States has a unique advantage in terms of imposing financial sanctions because of the centrality of the dollar and of U.S. capital markets to the international financial system, meant that the U.S. could impose more potent sanctions. The other side of the coin, however, was that essentially other tools of U.S. Statecraft became less popular over time. Foreign aid has never been a particularly popular measure for U.S. foreign policy, and U.S. foreign aid budgets as a percentage of overall spending began to decline. The U.S. public soured somewhat on trade. We saw this with Donald Trump's election in 2016, and we see this in Joe Biden's trade rhetoric since he got elected in 2020. We've seen recently, the U.S. appetite for using force abroad has also declined. as Americans have grown sick of the so-called forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So essentially, when you eliminate those other sort of policy substitutes, sanctions become the policy of first resort. And that's why you're seeing an increasing reliance on sanctions. It's not necessarily that they work better. They don't. But they are certainly potent. And they are the easiest tool that that U.S. policymakers can reach for, both members of Congress and presidents.
So you talked about how financial sanctions depend very heavily on the dominance of the U.S. dollar in global finance. And I wanted to expand a little bit more on that, because that also means that the use of sanctions would also encourage maybe adversaries and even our allies to diversify from the U.S. dollar to decrease their dependence and thereby the effect of sanctions on them. So is this a lose-lose situation? Can the U.S. continue to leverage economic statecraft or sanctions without pushing or encouraging diversification away from the dollar?
That is the $64 trillion question, Julia. And to be fair, advocates of economic statecraft and economic sanctions are correct to point out that to date, there has not been that much diversification away from the dollar. There's a couple of reasons for this. The first is that you're correct that countries like China and Russia are wary of the dependence on the dollar. They would love to be able to rely on the dollar less. The problem is that that's a two-way street. Other countries also need to rely less on the dollar, and they have less reason to. The dollar remains a fundamentally attractive global reserve currency, both because of the liquidity of U.S. Capital markets, as well as trust in the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department to maintain the soundness of the dollar. In contrast to that, no one really trusts Russian authorities to actually keep the ruble in any way as a stable currency. And there is a great deal of wariness among a lot of the trading states about relying too much on China's renminbi, which is still technically not convertible, although it mostly is convertible. Now, that said, some allies have also attempted to at least partially diversify away from the dollar. After the Trump administration reimposed sanctions on Iran and withdrew from the JCPOA, they were able to sort of globalize U.S. sanctions by forcing SWIFT to, you know, take the Iranian central bank out of the SWIFT network. As a result of that, European countries began to create something called INSTEX, which was essentially an attempt, a financing mechanism that was designed to bypass the dollar, that would no longer be reliant on the dollar. And a lot of people at the time thought, okay, this is the beginning of the end. This is an example of the dollar losing its utility. The thing is, INSTEX wound up proving less impressive than a lot of people thought. It didn't really facilitate much in the way of international transactions with Iran. Indeed, the Iranians have been thoroughly frustrated with it. And so the truth is that, and this might sound implausible, but the dollar is, if anything, more central now to global finance than it was 10 years ago. Part of this is because it's only recently that the United States could be thought of as really exceeding or abusing its sanctioning power. The other part, though, is that in order to replace the dollar, you have to have an alternative. And the alternatives look less attractive to the dollar now than they did 10 years ago, because the primary alternatives would be the euro and the renminbi. The renminbi has had some issues, particularly in the last 6 or 7 years, and I don't think we need to go into the problems regarding the euro. The third possibility, which is often, you know, bandied about a lot, is the idea of cryptocurrencies, right? Things like Bitcoin or what have you. And there's no denying that cryptocurrencies, in theory, are a way to route around dollar-based transactions. The problem is that cryptocurrencies pretty much only have that utility. And even there, they have limited utility, because at some point, if you're going to use crypto to exchange goods and services, most people who get the cryptocurrency have to then convert it back into something they can actually spend. And so the ability of cryptocurrency to be used remains heavily constricted. And also, in contrast to most forms of currency, most currencies have what we would call sort of standards and network properties, which means that the more someone uses a currency, the more useful the currency is, right? If more and more people accept the dollar increases its, you know, as utility. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, that's not true with cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. The more people that use cryptocurrency, the less efficient that currency is to use, actually. This is because of various blockchain properties that I don't entirely understand, but needless to say that the more people that use crypto, the more energy it starts to tax. and therefore the less liquid it actually is. So crypto is a potentially useful tool to sort of evade sanctions as a one-off. It's not a permanent substitute.
I see. And I also wanted to touch on another controversial point about sanctions, which is its great impact on the civilians of a country, while a lot of the times not really affecting the country's policies themselves. We've seen, for example, financial sanctions as a method of directly sanctioning a group or preventing banks from working with a group. Correct me if I'm wrong. And maybe that has made sanctions more precise. But I'm wondering if we have made progress in making more precise sanctions, or if there is a future direction where we can use sanctions more precisely.
The way I would put it is that we have made progress, but not nearly as much progress as policymakers like to think. So there's no denying that financial sanctions are probably somewhat more precise than trade sanctions, because after all, if you're punishing actors by hitting their bank accounts, they have to have bank accounts in the first place to hurt them. And so that usually means, particularly when you're targeting the developing world, you are targeting elites. The problem is that, you know, if you target an economy's elite, eventually that does trickle down and you are going to be hurting the target's population more broadly. And so as a result, the idea that I think there was a belief or a myth 5 or 10 years ago that targeted sanctions were like the precision-guided munitions of economic statecraft. But much like those precision-guided munitions, which will still kill innocent civilians if used improperly, the same is true of financial sanctions. And also, it's worth pointing out that very often, if you take a look at the targets of financial sanctions, they are often countries that are already have been targeted with trade sanctions anyway. And so it's not like there's any particular relief for targeted populations. There's a fair amount of academic research on the effect of financial sanctions on target populations. And the conclusion is that none of this is good. That target populations still usually experience a decline in the standard of living. In terms of UN human development indicators, there are declines. In terms of repression within these countries, that also goes up. So by and large, nothing good usually happens as a result of this. And the additional problem is that the longer that sanctions are imposed, the more fertile the ground for corruption, which is a long-lasting problem for a lot of these countries.
So despite the limitations that we talked about, and even potential harms, it sounds like sanctions are here to stay as a foreign policy tool in the U.S. What changes would you say need to be made to our current sanctions strategy to prevent a lot of the harms that we've discussed and maybe increase sanctions' effectiveness in the future?
So, you know, if I was the sanctions czar, and let's face it, that sounds like a really cool job, I would say a few things. First of all, I would want any law passed by Congress mandating sanctions to include a sunset provision that essentially would require Congress to reaffirm, let's say, every 2 or every 5 years, the idea that sanctions are going to be continued. Because as it stands now, you know, the sanctions last in perpetuity. It requires a act of Congress to reverse them, and Congress isn't prone to do that. So you need members of Congress to be on the record, you know, on a regular basis saying, yes, I support this immiseration of a target population. I also think that basically there should be, just as the State Department, for example, has to do annual reports on human rights or religious freedom, I would mandate that the Treasury Department has to do an annual report in terms of discussing the impact, as it were, of sanctions, not just on targeted elites, but also on target populations. So we make it very clear what the costs of U.S. foreign policy are. The third thing I would want to do would be to essentially revive and or create a new version of COCOM. COCOM was a Cold War era informal coordination mechanism among the United States, NATO allies, and a few European neutral countries, basically designed to restrict technology, high technology exports to Warsaw Pact countries. I think one of the ways, it's a general rule that the more multilateral sanctions are, the more effective they will be. And I also think that if you multilateralize U.S. sanctions, it reduces the more frivolous use of them, as it were. And so it would be an interesting idea to essentially reassure our allies that we do care about whether or not they cooperate or not, and that we're not going to unilaterally impose sanctions via SWIFT, let's say, except under very extreme circumstances where you can really and legitimately say that national security interests are a threat. And so it would be interesting to create a review mechanism whereby there are lower level issues such as human rights or what have you, where you could get multilateral buy-in to impose sanctions. And because you got multilateral buy-in, presumably, they would both be more effective and be rarer.
All right. Professor Dresner, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. It was such an insightful conversation.
Oh, you flatter me, Julia. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.